So we strengthened each other's resolve, I think, by being the only guys we knew that felt that rock and roll was everything. You know, it wasn't just a weekend thing, wasn't a hobby, you know, wasn't something we were going to grow out of.
Yeah.
You know, so we were totally dedicated to it. And I think we were the only two guys that were like that. You know?
Many people know him for his role as guitarist and backing vocalist in the E Street Band. Many others know him for his role on The Sopranos. And still many others know him for his work on the radio show Underground Garage. He is Little Steven, otherwise known as Miami Steve, otherwise known as Stevie Van Zandt. Welcome to Rock Conversations. I'm Rob Bob, the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll, and what an interview we have for you today. In addition to being a musician, an actor, and a political activist, Stevie Van Zandt is now a published author. His brand new book, Unrequited Infatuations, is incredible. If you're listening before the holidays, I would highly recommend you buy the rock and roll fan on your Christmas list a copy of this. And if you're listening after the holidays, you can still buy it for yourself or as a gift for someone else. Let's not waste any more time here. Let's get to our rock conversation with Stevie Van Zandt.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
Because I'm a radio geek, one of my favorite chapters in your book is Gangster Days, Garage Nights, where you talk so much about radio throughout the years. Do you have a favorite era as you look back? Was it the 60s? Was it the 70s? Or is it today with your underground garage?
well, there was the two great eras, you know, really, was the AM era and the FM era. You know, we really did have great radio, you know, from before I was born, you know, basically. You know, not that it was a pop world. It was a pop era in the 50s and early 60s, right up until FM started, which was like 67, 68, somewhere in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And at that point, things started to change. And, you know, the DJs started talking more. And it was more relaxed. You know, it was longer songs. So when I, you know, started my radio format, I kind of wanted to do a bit of both. You know, I wanted it to be more of a more AM in a way of pop hits.
Sure.
But they were pop rock hits. You know, they weren't pop music by today's definition. But I did want the DJs to back announce them in great detail. You know, I didn't want to continue this practice of, you know, young generations thinking this music falls off trees, you know. I wanted to make sure we talked about the writers, talk about the producers, you know, talk about who's on it, what other bands the artists might have been in, you know, have a little conversation about the records. But I didn't want to play anything over 3.5 minutes. I wanted it to be a rock and roll dance party. I you know, play very, very slow, very few slow songs.
No
Stairway to Heaven and no Inagata Davida. You know, it's really only some of the soul.
Yeah.
You know, Smokey Robinson, you know, I might play or the Stones. The Rolling Stones really are the kings of the ballad. You know, they got more great slow songs than anybody.
You know, but I love irony, and there's some irony in this that Kid Leo was one of the first DJs to really support Bruce and his music. And then you brought him on board with your station.
Yeah, I was very, very proud to do that because he was extremely important. One of the very, very few rock DJs who was number one in his market, you know. And then he worked for a record company for years.
Yeah.
So, we kind of got him out of retirement. And, I was really happy about that. And Bill Kelly, who had been working for free on one of those college type stations like FMU or FUV, you know, I think it's FMU. I was happy to give him his first paycheck also because he's really quite an innovator. And a lot of my format is really influenced by Bill Kelly's format, which was almost anything goes, you know. I'm a little more restrained, you know, than him.
Yeah.
But it was important for me to connect the dots, you know, and that's why we play not only the cover songs, but we play the originals and talk about where they come from. And we play all 70 years of rock and soul. And that was the thing that people said could not work. And I said, of course it's going to work, you know, because people are curious, you know, they want to know where things come from. You know, and I did handpick the song, so it's my taste. But
that's okay, though. You have to have a curator, right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, but mostly it's we have introduced over 1,000 new bands, by the way. You know, and so it's not just older music. You know, we play the new stuff more than anybody. And if Rolling Stones or Paul McCartney or Cheap Trick, Joan Jett puts out a new record, we're the only ones who play it. So it became really an important sort of concept.
We are talking with Stevie Van Zandt. His new book, Unrequited Infatuations, is absolutely fantastic. I want to talk a little bit about Bruce and the E Street Band. But before we do, I want to play a clip of an interview I did years ago with Randy Brecker, a trumpeter. And here's what he had to say.
My recollection was the horn section was myself, my brother and Dave Sanborn, and we were trying to figure out what they wanted on a tune called 10th Avenue Freeze Out, because we had just some blank music paper on the stand, and we finally came up with some things and spent a few hours recording something, and we kind of thought we were finished with the tune, and then a guy kind of waltzed into the control room and said, no, that's not the way it's supposed to go, and it turns out that was Miami Steve Van Zandt. So we had to start all over with the.
Is that how you recall the session taking place?
Yeah, it was. I thought, you know, they were happy to see me just because, you know, maybe it signaled the end of the session, because, you know, that thing was like looking like it was going to just be eternal. It was just a weird moment where I happened to be there, and, you know, I happened to be arranging horns for Southside Johnny and the Atterbury Jukes at that time. So I was, you know, used to it. And I knew that genre very well. You know, it was really a, you know, a stacks soul type of song. So, you know, and they weren't, whatever they were doing was just not right. You know, we wanted it to be authentic, you know, and they were probably being, you know, too creative. You know, they're some of the greatest horn players in New York, or the greatest horn players.
Absolutely.
In New York.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, they probably were trying to, like, not be boring and traditional, you know. But that's, you know, I'm a traditionalist. So I kind of probably, you know, gave them parts that were, you know, more boring than they would have thought of themselves. You know,
well, I think it's fair to say the parts turned out okay. And as a trumpet player, you know, that's one of my favorite albums. You've got that, and then Meeting Across the River, where Randy plays again. Oh, fantastic tremendous, tune.
Tremendous, tremendous. I happen to be there for that also. You know, I was only at 3 or 4 sessions, and that was one I happened to be there for. It was just fantastic. It's one of my favorite things of all time.
Now, you're going to have to explain this, because you can do it so much better than I, but there was a point in the song Born to Run where Bruce was playing something and you heard something different. Can you kind of explain to the layperson what was going on?
Yeah, I can do it again.
Sorry. I should always ask someone, what question have you been asked the most that you don't want to get asked again?
That's one of them.
Let's do this. Let's
That's why I wrote the book.
Yeah, people can read it in the book. Yeah. Let's jump ahead. You know, you were involved with E Street Band with Darkness and then The River. You left the band briefly, I think, and then came back and really contributed. I think you produced or helped produce The River. And if I recall in the book, you say that's one of your favorite albums, if not the favorite. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite E Street records. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it was the first one I got production credit on. And it's also, I think, one of my favorite albums as far as Bruce's singing style. I like, there's a lot of soul music on that record, soul music roots, you know. And he doesn't do that often. He doesn't use that part of his voice that often. And he's just one of the great white soul singers of all time. And he never does it, you know. So I think that's probably got more of that style mm-hmm. on that record than any other album. I think.
I found it interesting your reaction when Bruce decided to cut a lot of the slow songs when you were supposedly going to play the whole album live. great thing from the book where you said, look at Europe. They love their slow songs.
Yeah. We're doing the River Revisited, tour, the last tour we did might've been a tour.
I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I'm just loving it. It's probably my second favorite tour we've ever done, that or maybe Darkness. Now we're going to Europe and he says, we're not going to do it anymore. We're not going to do it because we're doing the entire River album. So we decided not to do it because it was too many slow songs. I don't know why he decided Europe, didn't like slow songs and America did, it didn't make any sense because at that time, the Eurovision, festival. Yeah. It was all slow songs, and I would go and see rock bands. Most of the 80s in Europe. And I would go see big rock bands, Italian rock bands. And they would do nothing but slow songs all night, So, it was disturbing because, that's some of our greatest fans. And here we are doing what I felt was our greatest album. I thought we should do our greatest album for our greatest fans.
I would admit that I might have been a little ticked had you not played Point Blank, for instance.
Yeah.
We are talking with Stevie Van Zandt. His new book is Unrequited Infatuations. I want to shift gears if we could talk a little politics. It's interesting how people have epiphanies. Yours, I think it's fair to say, came when a little kid came up to you on the streets of West Berlin.
It was really our first serious European tour. And a guy came up to me and said, why are you putting missiles in our country? And it was a surprising question. I didn't really get it at first, but it stayed with me for a while. And I realized that the guy was, once you travel overseas, you're no longer looked at like a guitar player or a Republican or a Democrat. He was looking at me as an American. And I had never really thought of myself that way before. It was kind of a revelation. I was like, man, I wonder, maybe I am putting missiles in this country. If I'm an American citizen and we're supposed to be a democracy, of course we're not really a democracy, but we're working on it. We're actually going backwards these days. But if we are somewhat of a democracy then I'm responsible for what we're doing as a citizen. And I wondered what else we were doing. So I started studying our foreign policy since World War II. And that led to a whole, becoming engaged in politics at first, just to write about it. I was just going to write about the politics, because we work in a storytelling medium. So you convert the politics into stories. But then by the time I got to South Africa, which was about halfway through my career there, my 80s career, at that point, I switched from, I went from artist journalist to artist journalist activist. That's when I actually got involved.
Were you ever concerned that there might be backlash to your professional career if you took too visible a political stand that was unfavorable with some?
Yeah, but fortunately or unfortunately, I didn't have any commercial success to lose. So, you know, it was like quite liberating. I didn't have to worry about that. You know, I don't think I would have done anything different, even if I had success. But it was just not something, it was not really a concern. I was on an artistic adventure, and then which became an artistic and political adventure. And I wasn't really concerned about what the marketplace thought of it.
And I suspect sometimes those are the strongest leaders, those who don't, you know, they don't test the winds. They don't want to see, you know, what might happen. They just say, I'm doing it, you know, because it's here and I'm here. Let's do it.
Yeah, I was really obsessed, you know. You know, I wouldn't recommend it, you know, for people who are, unless you're already successful and you got, you know, enough money in the bank to live on. But I was just obsessed and I didn't care about anything. It was very, you know, very naive, really, and very, you know, very thoughtless in terms of what repercussions might come from it or consequences. But I was just totally focused and totally obsessed. So, you know, it was just going to be what it was going to be.
During that time and through that work, you got to know, after his release, Nelson Mandela. And I want you to tell the story, if you would, please, about the dinner you organized in New York City that seemed to be patching up some concerns, political concerns, until you got a phone call.
Oh, yeah, it was a tough situation. It was very complicated, really, which I go into great detail about. But there was a bit of an attitude going on. This is hard to summarize, actually, but basically, I sold. They were having trouble selling tickets. You know, they were having trouble raising money. I think it was 10 different cities promised Mandela like $500,000 each for the ANC for the election that was about to happen. You know, and they were having trouble raising the money. At that point, the activists were taking over, and we had we had been the leaders of that movement, and we weren't. Once the activists took over, you know, the regular activists, you know they weren't really treating us with much respect. So I sold, we ended up, you know, I got Bobby De Niro and he gave me his restaurant and then we brought in Spike Lee and we brought in Eddie Murphy to be the, us four would be the hosts.
Sure.
Of the dinner, you know, and sold dinner with Mandela. Whatever it was, like $2,500 a ticket and we raised the $500,000. And just before he's supposed to arrive, I get a phone call saying, well, you know, he's a little tired, so not going to really make it. He's not going to make it. So I said, well, that's really disappointing, to say the least. So I'm going to have to give everybody their money back, you know. And they were like, whoa, 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 whoa. what are you talking about? They were like, that's my money. You know, that's our money. And I'm like, nah, at the moment, it's my money, you know. And I promised dinner with Mandela. And if they're not getting dinner with Mandela, you know, my word is my word. And I'm giving the money back. So suddenly Mandela wasn't so tired and he came down. You know, his handlers, which, you know, I'm sure they were thinking of in his best interest, but you know, they were used to dealing with white liberals,
sure,
which I am not, you know. So, you know, but he came down and he was great, you know. And my only conversation with him was there.
Yeah. One final political related question. I think it's one final. There might be two. Either I'm listening to the wrong music these days and missing something, or is there a dearth of politically inspired songs, like, you know, like we saw in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s?
Different world, man. It's a whole different world, you know. It really is. First of all, what was going on in the 60s, 70s, and 80s was very, very well hidden. You know, there was, on the one hand, especially the 80s, and before the 80s, it was, you know, it was the war. My dog is participating here.
I love it. I'm glad mine isn't.
You know, at first we went from very, very big issues like, you know, stopping the war in Vietnam and civil rights and you know, so it went from big stuff. And then there was some cultural shift, you know, which brought on the political activism, the political subject matter was introduced by Bob Dylan. Just a general consciousness, which didn't exist. All right. Then the cultural shift took place and you started to see, you know, Buffalo Springfield for what it's worth and Jefferson Airplane Volunteers and the ultimate, which was Neil Young's Ohio with Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. And then there were, of course, the anti-war songs and those kinds of things. But then in the 80s, things shifted again, and they shifted to a more, you know, mourning in America sort of, you know, illusion of the country's success, you know, as Ronald Reagan put us into debt for the first time in our history, which we'll never get out of now. And suddenly all of the bad stuff started to happen internationally. It always had been. A lot of bad stuff had always been happening internationally, but we didn't really know it and weren't really conscious about it. And so now suddenly, maybe because of the media becoming a bit more of a mass media.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, we didn't have, you know, no internet yet or anything like that, but it was starting to become a mass media. And suddenly I decided to write about a lot of the things that were behind the scenes, you know, that were not obvious, you know. So then, you know, cut to 20 years later, whatever it is, 30 years later. And here's Trump, you know, basically committing all of his crimes in broad daylight, which was so surprising and so unusual that to this day, nobody knows how to deal with it. You know, I mean, there's no reason why the guy isn't in jail. He's, you know, he's obviously a criminal on many, many levels, on many, many crimes. And because he's just like proud of it and just, you know, just way out front about everything, you know, they're just, I mean, the guy on videos, you know, tell the crowd to go down and overthrow the government. You know, you would think that would be illegal, wouldn't you? You know?
Yeah. It's interesting. Your take is interesting that the things are so out there in the open that maybe singer songwriters aren't inspired to write about
it. That's it. You know, when you get a government at that time that was bragging about putting kids in cages to deter immigration. I mean, they're bragging about putting kids in cages. You know, what are you gonna write about? You know, so I think that was part of it too. You know, it was just all so openly criminal and out front that, you know, it just didn't require any kind of shining a light. You know, what I did all during the 80s was shining lights on places that people were not looking, you know, and couldn't see, you know, like South Africa or you know, the invasion of Nicaragua, you know, that was about to happen, or the problems in Haiti, or, you know, whatever I was writing about. Suddenly it just didn't seem relevant anymore. It seemed redundant. So, you know, I did two albums in that period, and the only two albums I've ever done that were not political. So
we're talking with Stevie Van Zandt. His new book is Unrequited Infatuations. In the few minutes we have left on Rock Conversations, I want to talk a little about your acting and then segue back to music. The book recounts it in a great way, so I don't want to take time doing it here, but suffice it to say, I think there were 10 things that all seemed to come together or flow, beginning with a conversation about the Rascals. So readers, check that out. And what I'm alluding to is the end result was you became Syl on The Sopranos.
Yeah, it was really a lot of bizarre circumstance that led to it. I never intended to be an actor, you know, no interest in it.
And they wanted you to be the lead. I don't think I knew that till I read the book.
Yeah. Most people didn't know that. I didn't talk about it, you know. But yeah, and then, you know, of course, HBO was like, you know, are you out of your mind? We were about to make this big investment, and you want somebody who's never acted before? You know, it's crazy. So,
impossible, I'm sure, in a short couple sentences to sum up your experience with The Sopranos. But maybe you could talk about your relationship with the person we know is James Gandolfini. You call him Jimmy. I don't want to, you know, overstep the bounds, but a really special relationship.
Yeah. And I did with the whole gang, you know, starting with David Chase, who what a ballsy move, you know, to have somebody like me never acted before, you know, and I go to this, you know, turn out to be the greatest acting school in the world, of course. Jimmy, I think we bonded on the common ground of neither one of us particularly liking the spotlight. You know, I think, you know, he was a character actor and I was a side man. And that was really, I think, our natural inclination. So suddenly, in both of our cases at various times, we had to rise to the occasion of being the leader, being the boss, being in the spotlight. And I think we kind of bonded on that basis. And we're going to do a lot of things. You know, we're going to open a club together, a restaurant, and all kinds of things. But I miss him. I miss him every day. And the industry, I think he would have been one of the greatest actors in history.
Oh, he was fantastic in so many, like you say, as a character actor and as a lead man. Yeah. I want to circle back to the deliberations that you had on whether to take the part. And what I found very entertaining, and I hope you can explain it real quickly, is you went out with Peter Wolf, formerly of the Jay Giles Band. And he provided some very sage advice.
Yeah. We were at a place called Elaine's on the Upper East Side. And I was a little worried about it because some of my friends, were not that thrilled about the idea of me being on TV. I said to Pete, you know, I'm kind of worried about it. I mean, first of all, I don't even know if I can do it. I don't know if I can act. This first script is good, but what if the second one sucks? You know, what do you do then? You know, we're used to being a little bit more in control. I mean, we're in control of our lives artistically in the music business. You know, you're pretty much in control of it artistically. You're not in control of it in terms of the marketing and you know, sales and stuff like that. That's somebody else's job. But, you know, artistically, we're used to, you go out and sing a song or you play a guitar part. You come in, you listen to it, and you say, let me try it again. I'll see if I can do it better. Acting, you know, you act and you see it 6 months later. You know, and you have to get used to, you know, if the director's happy, then you got to be happy. And that's giving up a lot of trust, you know. So I was kind of uncomfortable about the whole idea. And especially I said, you know, what if it ends up being a bad show? And so Peter went into this whole rap about, you know, did you know this one had a TV show and that one, you know, Jimmy Stewart and, Steve McQueen. And he went down this whole list of people who I didn't know had TV shows, you know, who ended up being famous movie actors. And he says, TV's funny that way. He says, you know, if it's great, it's great. If it's not, nobody's going to remember it. You know, so
a beautiful line.
Don't even worry about it. Yeah. Yeah.
We're talking on Rock Conversations with Stevie Van Zandt. In the waning minutes we have, I want to circle back and talk a little bit about music and specifically about the relationship you have with Bruce. How ironic. You know, I told you earlier, I love irony, that you played a consigliere in The Sopranos, but you have really been Bruce's consigliere for years. What makes that relationship work and what makes it so special?
I think it's how it started. You know, I keep coming back to that because I think that's what has held us together as best friends, really, all of these years. When we started, there weren't that many bands. You know, if you went to your high school dance, it was an instrumental group. There was not four or five guys playing and singing. You just didn't see it. And you know, and suddenly the Beatles come February 9th, 1964, and a country that had no bands the day before, the day after, everybody had a band. I mean, that's how much the Beatles influenced our culture. It was immediately a band culture. And everybody had a band in a garage on February 10th. And like I like to say, mercifully, most of them stayed there. But, you know, about a dozen of us got into the area. You know, it was kind of like a bit of a circuit from, you know, Freehold, where Bruce was, to Asbury Park, which was south, to the east, where the beach clubs were, to the north, in Middletown, where I was. So it was a bit of a, you know, square or parallelogram or something. But that was kind of our area. And in that area, there was about a dozen bands, and we all knew each other, you know. But I started going up to the Greenwich Village on the weekend, about an hour on the bus, and seeing bands at the Café Wa in the afternoon, Saturday afternoons. Café Wa is still there, by the way. Those bands would be like a year ahead of us. You know, in those days, things were changing fast, and there was a lot of information coming at you very quickly. And you know, the whole entire trends would come and go, you know, 6 months or a year. And so I went up to, you know, basically steal ideas, you know, and bring it back to my band. And that's why, you know, we were one of the best bands in our area. And I ran into Bruce doing the same thing. You know, he'd be up there on the weekend and doing the same thing I was. And so we got friendlier because of that and started coming up to the city together. You know, I go over to his house and Freehold, and then we take the bus from there. So, you know, in those days, you know, I was the only one with long hair in my area. He was the only one with long hair in his area. I got kind of high school because I had long hair.
Who knew that the hair was the bond?
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, if you had long hair, you were friends. And if you were in a band, you were friends. And if you had long hair and were in a band, you were best friends. You know, that's just how it worked. But we you know, I was kind of like the only freak in my area, and he was the only freak in his area. And you know, if you're the only freak, you know, you start thinking maybe there's something, you know, wrong with you. But if there's two of you, I think, you know, you figure maybe we're onto something here, you know. And I think so we strengthened each other's resolve, I think, by being the only guys we knew that felt that rock and roll was everything. You know, it wasn't just a weekend thing, wasn't a hobby, you know, wasn't something we were going to grow out of.
Yeah.
You know, so we were totally dedicated to it. And I think we were the only two guys that were like that. You know?
So real quickly, was Bobby Jean on Born in the USA written about you?
I don't know. We'll never know.
Okay. I never thought that until you said that he didn't play the demo for you. And then it kind of dawned on me that maybe this is about little Steven and not about Bobby Jean. Other question I have, did I read right that you gave him the idea to think big with regard to, as his image was changing, understandably, as he became more successful and getting maybe away from the working man image, that you came up with the food bank donation idea?
Yes, I did.
Which is fantastic, by the way. You know, what a great way to give back.
Yeah, it was just something, you know, he's like, you know, we're about to have success because I left the band by then. And so we were having one of our last conversations before the album came out. And he says, you know, judging from the, you know, the pre-sales, you know, this thing's going to be big, you know. And he's like, you know, you could tell he wasn't all that comfortable with the idea of suddenly, you know, being big like that, you know, commercially, because we had been struggling so long, 15 years or longer by then. That was almost 20 years by then.
Right. Yep.
You know, and I just thought to myself, you know, what would be a statement, you know, that would really be different? Because, you know, people were doing, they do fundraisers, you know, maybe once a year or something, you know, come around Christmas time, you do something. I thought, you know, what a great statement it would be, because he had a working class identity, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, he was the great, great writer for the working class and a great spokesman for them, even though he wasn't exactly one of them, you know? I mean, he never had a job, as far as I know. He never had a legitimate job. So, you know, it was kind of a... how can I say it? You know, it was almost like something that was understood, but it wasn't as real as it could be. Not that it needed to be, because, you know, art is art. You know, art is not reality. You know, art is art for a reason. You know. But it was an idea. I just thought, you know, what if you did a benefit every single city, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
And I said, well, you know, I gotta think about that, you know. Well, that's what we ended up doing.
The book is Unrequited Infatuations, a must read for rock and roll fans. The author is Stevie Van Zandt. Man, thanks for taking time. It's been great.
Oh, my pleasure, my friend. My pleasure.